Okay. My dearest parents-in-law are very ill, 84 years old, living in Europe. My husband loves his mother very much. He said if his mother passed away, he didn't want to be at the funeral. I don't think it's a good idea. How can I help him and myself in the way of Buddha mind? I'm afraid my husband will break down. Well, I think one of the things is it's just when there is a strong bond like that and they're not wanting to, say, accept reality, then, one, it hasn't happened yet, so it's all conjecture and speculation, so that a lot of it is pointing to the positive aspects of using a funeral and as a occasion for expressing gratitude and closure, so that even if there isn't feel like it at the time, then it is a way to internalize, acknowledge the passing of someone who is dear to us, and then to use it as an opportunity to reflect on, say, you know, things like gratitude and acknowledging that to ourselves, so that then it becomes something that is quite positive. And I think in human society, there's since time immemorial, there's always been ceremonies around death that help to create a sense of closure, acknowledgement, pulling together with friends and relatives, so that it's just something that fills a need in the human heart. Please repeat the phrase that included nimitta and your name in some form. Can you give context, expand a little on this? Well, the word is pasadaniya nimitta. So pasadaniya it has the same root as pasano. Not exactly the same word, but the same root. And so what nimitta is sign, image, object of attention, and pasadaniya is something that brings forth faith or confidence and joy, well-being. So that the context of lifting up an inspiring image is when any of the hindrances come into the mind and there's negativity or the mind is feeling oppressed, then one of the ways that the Buddha encourages to counter that is to lift up an image that inspires confidence and well-being. And that's something that, it's really important to recognize that we can do that. We can lift up anything in our mind. We can think anything, and we do. but it's helpful to have some kind of boundaries and some kind of encouragement for ourselves, and to recognize that we can be, when the mind is feeling oppressed or constricted, we can lift up an image that expands that feeling. What is the difference between loving kindness and compassion? How can one evoke or manifest them if he or she has never experienced them before? And signed with lots of gratitude, for your teachings and everyone who organized this retreat. The difference between loving kindness and compassion, and it isn't as if they're, you know, absolutely separate, and there's this huge boundary in between them, but it's they're slightly different nuances all. So that loving kindness is the wish for happiness, well-being, and the compassion is more directed to the overcoming of suffering or difficulty, so that there's a slightly different nuance to it. And they're obviously they're quite related, and they have the tone is one of warmth, care, kindness, and so that's the feeling tone. So we've all experienced those kinds of emotions, and so to be able to evoke that, I'm sometimes just drawing into the memory or paying attention to the feeling in the body, or bringing up an image of someone who one cares for, but isn't hugely invested in the sense of not somebody that one has, say, a romantic love for, but one who's it's more of a maybe a more global and expansive quality, or even sort of like the feeling you see, like a little puppy or a kitten. there's not many people who feel really neutral, they evoke a sense of, That's the kind of that sense of caring and concern and that wishing for their well-being, wishing for them not to experience difficulty. We direct that same wish toward ourselves as well as toward others. Okay. It seems I have returned to remedial meditation practice. That's a nice way of saying it's not working. I can't seem to find ease in my body, let alone my breath. It feels like I'm stuck in physical pain, an invisible barrier I can't seem to penetrate. Acceptance and loving kindness are being applied, but without much movement. I'm trying to develop concentration on the breath. So far, no piti or sukha. What to do? Well, I think one of the things is not one of the things that's really frustrating is waiting to get those results that we're hoping for. And feel that we should be getting. I set aside 10 days to go to a Thanksgiving retreat. I should be getting something out of this. really pay attention to the kind of the mindset. What have we invested in it? Trying to get out of it. Be willing to just learn to experiment with things that don't like. Sometimes I'm really trying to develop concentration on the breath. Just go do walking meditation. Inhabit the body, move. go through the chanting book and learn a chant. You know, do something that the mind engages in, and that is, you know, quite wholesome. It's skillful. It reminds one of Dhamma. There's all sorts of things that we can be doing. Sometimes with Saint monks at the monastery, nothing seems to be working. I'm meditating this way, I'm meditating that way. I'll just go grab a broom and sweep the trails. Sometimes we obsess with trying to get the meditation down, get the meditation technique, and my meditation. So it becomes very burdensome, and to do something like that. Just doing something simple, doing walking meditation, picking up a simple chant that we even know, and just a recitation of the the qualities of the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. Say that chant: Iti piso bhagava arahaṃ sammā sambuddho. It's a recitation of the qualities of the Buddha, qualities of the Dhamma, qualities of the Sangha. Those are some skillful way to direct attention in a wholesome way. Or say, just go around the building and see if there's any trash around. Do something. It's really, do something that's, I can help somebody or help the place. These are things that we don't often think about because we tend to be, trying to get our meditation to work for us. This is interesting. I was struck by the suggestion you shared about orienting oneself toward what one can give to a moment rather than what one can get from a moment. This mind shift seems hugely beneficial. Would you expand on this? It's kind of similar just as what I was talking about just now. It's just that same kind of theme we tend to create tension and blocks and by... And the reality is that sometimes the meditation is really the pit. But on the grander scale of things, that's ordinary. Sometimes it goes well, sometimes it doesn't. And a lot of practice is being willing to be patient. Just being ready to receive a quality of peacefulness or tranquility, rather than trying to squeeze it out of every moment. that sense of patience is really important. Like I remember, it was really frustrating for most of us as Westerners. Practicing with Ajahn Chah in the monasteries there, and because we'd go to with this difficulty, this doubt, this problem, and 9 times out of 10, Ajahn Chah was his answer: just be patient. that was really makes you impatient and frustrated. But the more you hear that, you realize, it's really important, because that, and again, that how we frame patience is more like being willing to be present with what we're experiencing. Say, as opposed, usually patience is like putting up with something miserable and waiting for it to be over. Yes. Okay, I can be patient with this, and you're just sort of waiting it for it to end. But, and again, this is where this quality of giving to the moment, just being willing to be present, giving attention to the present moment, so that we can be ready to receive. And that quality of generosity, that kind of that heart one of the words that the idiom that's used the Buddha uses in talking about generosity is open-handed generosity. So that there's this open hand giving rather than holding back, so that we're doing things in a way where we're it's really open-handed and not holding back. There's a book about that. Is there a difference between mindfulness and awareness? Please explain. There's a difference. One is spelled M-I-N-D-F-U-S, and one is spelled A-W-A-N. These are just words in the English language that we try to approximate to a Pali term. And it is important to recognize that any translation is... not quite there. Some are closer than others, but say like mindfulness was actually made up. It didn't exist in the mid 1800s, and then it's actually Professor Rhys Davids thought it up as a way to describe this word sati in the Pali language. One of the early translators of Pali to is British and lived in Sri Lanka for many years, and it's not a bad word. It's okay, but same with awareness. I mean, it's actually a good word. But it's really important to go back and recognize, well, what is the Buddha actually describing when he talks about mindfulness? Because, and was it last night? I think I talked about it. Anyway, that there are constituents of qualities when we talk about mindfulness. And in the English language, it's kind of started to take on its own kind of meaning and has its own and there's assumptions that we make with a particular term or a phrase, and I think it's helpful to come back to the root of what... Well, mindfulness is actually, there's this cluster of qualities, of effort, of clear comprehension, of awareness, of a certain discernment of not being caught in the habits of the mind. And then mindfulness becomes something more textured and layered rather than one single thing that we've got a label for and a name and we think we know what it is because we got the name. So to recognize that some of these terms where it's going to take probably 200-300 years for some of these ideas to end up, say, well established in the English language, and who knows where it'll end up, because language changes, and which is one of the benefits of, say, of having a dead language like Pali, because it's kind of static. And you can go back and say, well, what was that referring to at that time, and how did the Buddha use it, and how was it presented? Because even and some things are it's easier to just take the say the word from Pali and start using it, say like. Say the word karma is pretty much, I think it's in the Oxford English Dictionary, and most dictionaries it's found its way into the English language. Doesn't necessarily mean it's used in the same way as the Buddha did. Same way, say like in the Thai language, sati is just used as let's say just taken from the Pali and then used in Thai, but it has connotations that are not really exactly very Buddhist either, because sometimes it's sort of like sometimes it means you've been able to keep enough sati so that you can still drive a car, and you're not too drunk. So it's these things, they drift. Okay, as I get deeper insights how conditioned the mind is, there is a sense of burden being released, but also a doubt began to arise. If the mind is conditioned, how is it even possible to arrive to the unconditioned? Does free will even exist, or am I just pushed around by kilesas? If the trick is to recognize that there is no free will, how can I sincerely believe that when I'm making choices to practice and do wholesome deeds, they really matter, and it's not my delusion? Please dispel my doubts. That's can I exercise free will to do that? I think it's just using the one of the phrases from the suttas, complicating the uncomplicated. So it's the mind is conditioned. But I think this is why it's so important to come back to the Four Noble Truths, rather than speculations about nature of mind. What's the condition? What's the unconditioned? Is there free will? Is there not free will? Because those are all questions about self or being. And as long as we frame that question from that basis, then we're always entangled. So when we can look from a framework of, Is there stress in the system? Is there difficulty there? Is there where is that coming from? How does that work? Then it's looking on a causal process as opposed to a being, an entity, a me, or a not me, a non-being. And so that then you've got an opportunity of doing what needs to be done. There one experiences the freedom and peace from that. Could you describe the detail of the Four Noble Truths? What are they? How do we apply to real modern lives? Well, real modern lives do have dukkha. We could spend the whole 10 days talking about details of the Four Noble Truths and say it is the container. But I think just that recognition of that there is dukkha, in the sense of dukkha being stress, suffering, discontent, dis-ease, dissatisfaction, and that there is a cause, and that there is a cessation, and that there is a path, a practice leading to that cessation. So that when we start to look at things from the perspective of the Four Noble Truths, then, especially in a modern life, you know, there's so much distraction that we're either impinged on or we have available to us to distract ourselves, so that to recognizing that many of these things that pull us where our mind keeps going is actually not peaceful or satisfying. And we have an option. And it's not about, say, the Four Noble Truths of me being the one who suffers, but it's more like this is an opportunity to understand causal processes so we can step back from the position of me here and the world outside, which is either confusing or enticing me. Okay, John, please explain the seven factors of awakening and how to practice them in this retreat. It's great appreciation for all that you do and model for us untrained run-of-the-mill people. Very sweet. Seven factors of awakening it begins mindfulness, first quality. So mindfulness, the investigation of dhammas, investigation of phenomena, effort, energy, joy, tranquility, concentration, samadhi, a settled quality of mind, and equanimity. So that those are qualities that we can bring into our practice there's many ways to work with it. One of the ways is, say, sometimes it's like approaching it in a linear way. Okay, I get this mindfulness bit, get awareness, collect my attention together, and then take a theme, reflecting, investigating on it, applying effort, lifting up a balanced energy into the mind, into the practice, paying attention to the result of that. A wholesome, positive result is usually sort of there's an energizing of the system, so that we experience it, say, both physically and mentally, which is this, say, joy is kind of piti. And we don't have to be gushing tears of joy, but just this sense, being kind of uplifted by the Dhamma, uplifted by the practice, feeling, it feels good, yeah, okay, getting on track here. Those are also feelings of piety, of a certain joyful quality. Tranquility is like an ease of a relaxing of the body, a relaxing ease of the mind. As the body and mind relax, feel easeful, the mind settles. It's usually say samadhi is the word that's used in scriptural language, and it's usually translated as concentration. And there's, that's a valid translation, but I think it's helpful to also recognize sometimes how we how tense we can make concentration, right? Trying to fix the mind on an object, whereas the feeling of the mind settling and becoming more steady and stable is maybe a better, a more apt description of, say, of samadhi. In the Thai language, when they translate the word samadhi, it literally means the firm establishing of the mind. That's a good translation, because that's what it is. It's a real firmness, stability, solid base for the mind. And then equanimity. And equanimity is an evenness of mind, and similarly a stability of mind that's not shaken by the internal likes and dislikes or the external changes that are taking place around one. There's equanimity. There's a stability, a solidity, because of clarity. So that's a looking at it from a linear perspective. But then the Buddha also teaches in a way of approaching these seven factors of awakening. From recognizing that they're both like a active and passive qualities, in the sense of active qualities being like investigation of Dhamma, effort, energy, joy. Those are sort of energizing qualities. You're lifting up, you're actively engaging in something. And then the qualities of tranquility, of samadhi, of equanimity, those are more, passive qualities, not in the sense of they're more settling, more toned down, and more subtle, and they have their place. And as when you're encountering particular states of mind, say if you're experiencing dullness and sloth and torpor, then you don't turn to tranquility, sort of concentration, equanimity as your kind of your go-to tool. That's just going to put you to sleep even quicker. You want to be paying attention to lifting up an object, engaging in investigation of Dhamma, lifting up effort, bringing something joyful up to the mind. Of course, the opposite is true as well. If you're experiencing a lot of restlessness there's a kind of restless, certain agitation that's going on in the mind, not very settled. Then you want to to be not stirring it up even more with the, say, investigations of Dhamma and starting to look at analyzing and figuring out, and spins the mind even more. So that was an energy. So those are appropriate tools at different times. But then the Buddha said, mindfulness is always useful. So that whatever practice one's doing, whatever one's encountering, one always wants to be lifting up the quality of mindfulness into the heart. Okay. Would you please talk a little bit about determination versus compassion in meditation? For example, as long sittings can cause pain and legs to go numb, when is it good to use determination to power through? And when is it good to have compassion for the body and to also not cause damage to the body so that it can be healthy for long-term practice? One is certainly the case that you want to be looking at this Buddhism project as a long-term perspective. I've heard it described as it's a marathon, it's not a sprint. So that recognizing that quality of just being compassionate and attentive to what are the needs of the body. But then, you know, if we're always looking to be, how do I maximize comfort and ease and well-being, and so I'm always, then you don't get very far either. Sometimes I just need to stick with it. And there isn't a fixed way or a doctrinal position that you say, okay, now I know this is when I need to do it. But it's more like you have to be attentive to what works and what doesn't work. I mean, it's not just an idea about it, but what helps the mind and the body to feel ease and clarity and understanding and able to embody qualities that are in line with the Dhamma, that are wholesome, that are skillful. So it always comes back to what is it that helps increase wholesome qualities and decrease the unwholesome qualities. And there's not a fixed line there. You actually have to figure that out yourself. You actually have to experiment and pay attention. And sometimes you succeed and you get it right, and sometimes you fail and you go down in flames, and that's okay. Taking that long-term view and being willing to experiment, because that's how we learn. We don't learn because Ajahn Pasano told you so, or you read it in a book, or you even thought it up yourself. It's through actual experience and trying things out and seeing what works. And then even when you see what works, you still have to keep experimenting and trying it out, because what worked today might not work tomorrow. And there's a certain humility and interest that you always have to apply to practicing Dhamma. And on a certain level, that's why it's so fascinating and interesting and inspiring, because it's not a fixed thing, but we can learn. We can really learn how to be free, how to experience peace. If someone spreads a harmful story about another that is untrue, but has convinced him or herself it is true, including his or her own embellishments, does this break the fourth precept? Well, the precepts are only there as guidelines, and the purpose of the precepts or function of the precepts is to have those guidelines to help us in our living and trying to live a skillful life. And Ajahn Chah emphasized over and over and over how much the purpose of the precepts was to understand volition, understand intention, so that when we understand intention and volition, then we start to understand ourselves much better. And that's where it becomes more clear, because people, and Debbie mentioned that this afternoon, how you're not really trusting these people that we're having to deal with, because the things that they have written and signed off as truth, it certainly wasn't how we experienced it. But it doesn't mean they haven't convinced themselves, or that isn't how they perceive it. But it's also around intention and volition, so that there has to be a certain degree of self-reflection. Many people aren't ready to actually reflect on their actions or reflect on themselves, reflect on their intentions. You can't sort of say, you broke a precept. You have the precepts are there for training, as opposed to making a legal decision or making a character judgment on somebody. On a certain level we live there has to be a commitment to integrity, and of course that's what the precepts help to support, is this commitment to virtue and integrity, and then that's where the nuances start to become more useful, because then it isn't just sort of lying, but then just a speech that's not quite true, or it's a little bit of an exaggeration, or it's something that is talking about others and with bits of information but filling in the gaps. It's actually one of the functions of our mind is to fill in gaps. And then, we end up in very weird universes, because we filled in the gaps in ways that don't really have much didn't really accord with reality, but the gap was filled. and we feel better because we've got those gaps filled. But that's what the mind does. So that's why it's so important to be reflective and be alert. It's a common phrase, if you see the Buddha on the road, kill him. Obviously, it's using hyperbole for effect, but I think it means to trust only in your own experience. At what point do the guidelines and precepts leave off and the way to proceed... guidelines and precepts leave off and the way to proceed on findings begin? I know it's not a linear path, but I'd appreciate your thoughts. Thanks so much for your deep understanding and clarity. Read the Dhamma. I think it's from either Chinese or a Japanese Zen story. And yeah, it's using hyperbole, but the guidelines and precepts are, and that's kind of like what I was talking about in the previous question, where the precepts and Dhamma teachings are things that we pick up and use as a means of shining light back on our own experience, so we understand ourselves and understand the ways in which we do create dukkha. In another light, there's a Ajahn Chah once taught Ajahn Sumedho and said that the vinaya or the precepts are for holding on and the Dhamma is for letting go. When you learn how to balance those two, then you'll be free from dukkha. So it's an interesting perspective in the sense that, yeah, there are guidelines and precepts that we hold on to. There's teachings that we hold on to in order to help clarify our understanding, our own ways of being in the world. And then say the teachings, the Dhamma, then there's always the encouragement for relinquishment, letting go, putting down. But you still have to do something. You still have to be something in the world. And those two have to sort of balance and harmonize and work together so that there's an opportunity for no disharmony, in the sense that one isn't confused about the world, one isn't confused about one's own intentions. One doesn't have an issue or an argument with the world, one's not trying to get anything out of it. One just sees clearly the way things are. But that takes this balance that we again experiment with, work with, figure out. We have to figure it out through our own experience. We've got the guidelines, we've got the tools, so just learning to be skillful with those tools. And it's sort of a heading, the asavas. Asavas being, there's translated in different ways, taints, outflows, effluence, inflows, cankers. The asavas. Why does the mind leave, go out, its still center? Because it's deluded. That's the function of avijja, lack of true knowledge. It just doesn't see clearly, it doesn't recognize its values, looking for something else, bound by ignorance and obstructed by craving. And it is those two together. It's a real double whammy. That's that. If it were, even if it was just sort of ignorance, that'd be kind of okay. Or if we're just craving on its own, you could work with. It's pretty straightforward. But when they go together, that makes it really tough. So this is why. Yeah, these tools of practice, the structures, the training, the teachings, having good spiritual friendships, having a good surroundings to be in, all of these things are a necessary support for one's growing understanding and ability to not be pulled along by the mind that goes out. Okay, last one's on protocol. Is it true that it's bad or disrespectful to point one's heel at a monk? It's actually not heel, it's your foot. It's the sort of the whole foot. And that's Thai culture. I thought that I read or heard this somewhere. Actually, it's even in the Buddha's time. I remember there's a sutta where was it Nagita? The one that... The one who got drunk on Pindabat, yes, on Andhra. there's some great stories in the Vinaya. in the suttas, you've got all these teachings, and the Buddha, teaches them, and they get enlightened, and sometimes it can be depressing. Where are the people like me? So then you go to the Vinaya, and it's and that's where the Buddha's got to. No, you should not do that. No, that really isn't good. Don't do that anymore. And anyway, what happened was there's a group of monks who they're always getting in trouble. And they thought it would be a really good idea to tell the lay people that something that's really meritorious is offering things that the monks don't get very often. And what they don't get very often is alcohol. So this, and then this monk he didn't know what was going. This was a monk who was actually quite accomplished, and he was had some psychic powers, and he'd. Anyway, he went on alms round, and he didn't make it back to the monastery. He sort of passed out. They had to bring him back to the to the monastery, and then he sort of laid him out, and then he's drunk, and he's sort of, and then he passes out again with his feet pointing to the Buddha. And then the Buddha uses, would that monk have done that before? So that was even the pointing one to his feet to somebody, even in Indian culture, and time of the Buddha was considered inappropriate. And so similarly, and certainly in Thai culture, that's very, you're trained from the time you're very little not to be pointing your feet. Anyway, I haven't even got very far into this question. Is it true that it's bad or disrespectful to point one's heels at a monk? I thought that I read or heard this somewhere. Sometimes I have felt the necessity to stretch out one leg or the other in the meditation hall. But as all the monastics sit up front, I feel that I will be pointing my heel at one monastic or another, and I really don't want to be disrespectful. If this is so, or if this is worrying too much about conventions, which causes suffering. Well, I mean, I think one is just when you know what a convention is. When you don't know what a convention is, and sort of you just don't know. So, but when you know it and realize that it has a significance for others, then it's appropriate to try to be alert to it as best one can, and sometimes if you're sitting and need to stretch out your legs a bit, one is just sort of standing up is a way to do it, or sort of pointing the feet off to, especially also to a shrine. It's sort of not. It's good not to be pointing one's feet in a shrine, and it is a convention, but it's also conventions that help us set a tone. Is that there are some things that are really worthy of reverence and respect, and so then it's, you know, either standing up or pointing one's feet off to the side somehow. Those are polite ways or sensitive ways of doing that. And in the end, it's not a really big deal. But it is, how do you say? Yeah, it is a politeness. And in human society, it's a good quality sometimes, greater harmony. Okay, so that's the last question.